This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Are you ready?
Hey, guys. Come on. Bring it in. Welcome back to the podcast dedicated to the most precious human pastime. I sit down with friends, idols, and inspirations of mine to shoot the breeze about music, life, family, food, whatever. I'm Gregory Porter, and this is The Hang.
It's interesting because I never thought that artists weren't supposed to do that. I never got the memo. And honestly, it's because of the artists that I looked up to were willing to speak out.
John Legend isn't just an incredible singer or a Hollywood superstar. He's an inspiration.
It was a great time to be friends with the leader of the free world because it gave me some opportunities to be in some rarefied spaces that I never dreamed of being in when I was a kid. It was pretty cool.
And one of the kindest souls I've ever had the pleasure of hanging with.
Are you in heaven right now? It's nothing but a white background.
I am. I'm in my daughter's bedroom. So we've all been doing this quite a lot these days.
Yeah.
I didn't know how to do any of this 9 months ago.
Yeah. Trust me, you won't want to miss a word.
All right, let's do it.
John Legend.
Gregory.
Good to see you, man. Good to see you.
My pleasure. Good to see you.
Do you remember when we first met or the only time we met?
I remember us meeting backstage. You were about to sing with Ledisi.
Yeah, and Quincy Jones' 85th birthday, BET.
Yes, absolutely. And I know you did that project. What did y'all do together?
Me and Ledisi?
Yeah, yeah. What was
we
that
did
song?
Everything Must Change on that show.
Oh, I was backstage just like going crazy because y'all were killing it. And it was a beautiful moment.
Yeah, right on, man. Thank you. And yeah. I mean, we don't need to talk about your career because it's just, bam, it's just so beautiful, so there, and so important.
Thank you.
And it's been the things that you do, the person that you are has been really
Thank you.
But for me, the roots and the beginnings of someone's genius, speciality, grace, where does that come from?
Well, it started for me in the church. It started for me with a family full of musicians and people who love Jesus and love music. So yeah. My grandfather was our pastor. My uncle took over for him when he retired. My grandmother was our church organist until she passed away. And then my mother was our choir director. My dad played the drums and sang in the choir. And we grew up in the Pentecostal church. And anyone who knows anything about the Pentecostal church knows how important music is to the service, how much energy it provides to the service. And so I was raised steeped in that music and that culture. I wouldn't be an artist today, I think, if it weren't for that upbringing in the church and being surrounded by so many musicians and people who loved making music and making a joyful noise, as they would say.
Yeah, so I grew up in Church of God in Christ.
Uh-huh.
So same, Holiness Church.
Exactly.
It's safe to say that, you know, even if it was your grandfather who was the pastor, you're still a PK. You're still.
Oh yeah, I qualify. Yeah. And then my dad also ministered as well. So okay. I was directly a PK, and then his brothers. So all the grandparent and my uncle were on my mom's side, but my dad also has a brother who's a pastor as well, who pastors in Cincinnati. He's a bishop now, and so it's all throughout the family. It was such a huge part of our upbringing and our musical upbringing.
Same thing here. And when I first heard your voice, I said, you know, there's a certain thing that happens in music. It's almost like there's a thing that can happen in jazz as well. Mm-hmm. Somebody sings behind the beat or does certain things that are only developed in a certain place. Mm-hmm. And only those who know can hear it. Yeah. And so there's a thing in your voice. I was like, oh, yeah, I know exactly where that came from. The first time that I heard you, I was walking down the street in, I was living in Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn. And I don't know if I was walking with headphones or somebody was blasting out their car window. Ordinary people.
Yeah.
And I said, I kind of stopped in my tracks because I was kind of the belief that like simplicity of sound and just a soaring voice, that era has passed. Mm-hmm. And so I said to myself, you know, this is how I like to present my music. I love, you know, single instrument and my voice. I love doing that. And I said, there's no way that I'll ever be able to get on the radio. Mm. And here you come blasting out of somebody's car. And I was like, these ordinary people. I was like, okay, I got to get a hold of that. So I listened and I was like, I know exactly where this brother is coming from. I'd be willing to put some money down that he came out of the church. And it's so evident.
Yeah.
And it was encouraging because at that time I didn't have a thing going on. I had done some, you know, few cool gigs, a couple of things with Wynton Marsalis, but I hadn't made my own record and I hadn't had that big push. And I swear to God, every time I go to sit down with record executives, I would bring you up.
Well, it's crazy because you say that, but then I was doing that about other artists when I was trying to get a record deal too. And I think we never know who we're affecting by what we're creating and what kind of inspiration that we're providing. And you're doing the same thing for somebody else now. And and I think all of us have those inspirations that show us what's possible, that, you know, that we're not crazy, that we're trying to make this kind of music or that we're trying to do this kind of thing. They're showing us that we could do this. And that doesn't mean we're going to be exactly like that artist. We're going to have our own thing. But just having those examples of inspiration, of success, it's helpful. It's helpful on a business side, like you're talking about when you go talk to these folks. But also just it lets you know that you're on the right track as an artist. And I think that's a good feeling to feel.
Yeah. As a jazz artist, as a jazz artist who had a kind of flexible and versatile voice, I could sing R&B, soul music, gospel. They were trying to push me in the ways that maybe would be the biggest bang for the buck, I guess.
Yeah.
And so I was like, well, wait a minute, you guys. I mean, we don't have to come with a, you know, right out of the bat, with this electrified thing, right out of the bat with this, you know, big thing where I got dancers and all this kind of thing. Uh-huh. I said we could use some of my songs. And it's still in the jazz tradition, black soul music tradition. Let's try that route.
Yeah.
And I had to fight for it. So you were one of my soldiers in that, whether you know it or not, because of the success of that song.
Yeah.
So thank you for that.
Well, it's so interesting. I don't know what your other influences were, and I don't even know how old you are, but I was born in 78. I grew up in the 80s and 90s, and, you know, I was going to high school in the early 90s and college in the late 90s, and there was so much cool music being made. You know, it was like a lot of the neo-soul era was during that time, the soulful hip-hop era with people like Tribe and you know, other groups that were incorporating jazz and soul into their beats. A lot of that was happening when I was in high school and college, and it was showing me the way that and Lauryn Hill's album come out in 98 and Erykah Badu was around that time as well. So a lot of these artists were showing me the kind of music that I wanted to make, the music that kind of connected with who I was and made me feel like, you know, it was helping me shape what I wanted to say in the world and how I wanted to say it. And I think every artist has those artists that come before them that help show them, you know, here's a way for me to do this and to do this successfully. And these are my examples of people that are able to do that.
Mm-hmm. In addition to, you know, gospel music that was happening in the house, was mm-hmm. there any, I mean, you know, the influences of Marvin Gaye and Curtis Mayfield can be heard in your approach. Mm-hmm. Is that music happening as well?
So it was happening by the time I was, you know, 15, 16, 17. But I would say it wasn't listened to very much when I was a kid, because we were like serious holiness folks where secular music wasn't even allowed to be played in the house. And then combine that with the fact that I was homeschooled for grade school and didn't even go to school with other kids until I was 12 years old. So that first 12 years was really no secular music at all, unless I was sneaking it on the radio somehow. But I was truly like gospel only during that time. So the transgressive music in my house at that time was gospel artists that sounded like they could have been R&B artists.
Turn that foolishness off.
if you just change one lyric, it would have been an R&B. Right. That was transgressive in my house at the time.
But you know I'm thinking of you.
Exactly. Jesus. Exactly. So by the time I got a little older, my parents got divorced. So that was one. Once they get divorced, things start loosening up. My dad was a single parent, and we were all living with him. And I think everything just kind of relaxed a bit as we were getting older, and also my parents got divorced. So I think everything was like, okay, we'll relax the restrictions. And so by the time I got to high school, I'm listening to whatever else my friends are listening to. And so a lot of that during that time was a lot of New Jack Swing era, R&B, some hip hop. I didn't really listen to a lot of hip hop until college when I went to Philadelphia, and all of my friends were very into hip hop, and I started getting into the more soulful hip hop. But I never
was. Soul or
yeah, exactly. Tribe, the Fugees, you know, different stuff like that. Arrested Development, all of that. Whereas when I was a little younger, hip hop was just a little too much for me. But by the time I got a little older, I came to really appreciate it, and then start to incorporate some of those sounds into my music as well. But in high school, it was a lot of the boy groups, you know, the male quartets, the Boyz II Men, the Jodeci's, I loved En Vogue, I loved SWV, I loved, you know, a lot of those
Powerhouse singers.
Yeah, powerhouse singers. A lot of them grew up in the church too, but they all were doing kind of like a New Jack Swing kind of production style. And that's what was hot for us when we were growing up in Ohio, like 91, 92, 93, that time period. That kind of stuff was hot.
Yeah, I was in college at San Diego State during that time. And I just even mentioning those names brings back certain feelings, certain sounds.
Yeah.
Cross color jeans. That may be before your time.
No, cross colors. Yes. I had both real and fake cross color.
All mine was fake, you know. That's really cool. You did a record with The Roots.
Yeah.
And you pulled this song selection. Who chose the songs for that record?
It was me and Quest. We would just sit there. So we're just sitting in the studio playing records. So Amir, you know, his record collection is vast, encyclopedic knowledge of music. And he and I would just sit and talk about the songs we wanted to do. And he would just be like, what about this one? What do you think about this one? What about this one? And we just sat there. And by the time we were done, we were like, okay, here's our list of songs we're going to try to cover. There's a couple that didn't make the album, but you know, we just started recording them and seeing what we could do with them. A couple of them, it's interesting, they kind of took on a life of their own as we kept playing it live, almost like a jazz artist would do, where yeah. you workshop it live a lot more before you record it, particularly with I Can't Write Left-Handed. We yeah. had started to go out and play it before we did the final version. We had a version, and then the live version we were doing was so good that we were like, we got to go back into the studio and re-record the studio version to try to capture some of that magic. And we did that with a couple of the songs. But it was such a beautiful experience making that record with them. Still one of the heights of my musical life, you know, just yeah. certain things where you feel like everything just comes together and you're in your zone musically and you're doing what you're supposed to do on this earth. It just feels like it's all there. And that's what I felt like when I was making that album.
The messaging in those songs
yeah.
is, I think, maybe the one of the most singular period that you guys are drawing from, that 70s soul kind of thing. Mm-hmm. That period of music is what I look to. And I feel, you know, you're an archetype of, because it's this real stories, positive trajectory of the music is upwards. What am I going to listen to that's going to make me better? And and this is what that music yeah. is. And so when I heard of the record, I was like, okay, well, maybe I was like, man, what is this going to be? Because it's just all good, right? And then when I heard the record, I was like, that's it right there. I mean, it's a concentration of the Black American experience in music, and you guys did a yeah. beautiful job with that, because you drew from jazz, you know, soul, and the gospel reggae. Is always up there in your voice, and the blues is there.
We did a reggae song too called Humanity, which it's funny, I looked at my Spotify, because sometimes I'll look and see what the most popular song on a certain album is, and Humanity is one of the most popular songs aside from the ones that we promoted. Apparently a lot of reggae fans really love our version of that song. And it was one of the most fun songs to perform live too. It's just an enjoyable, fun, soulful song to play live. But the one that really stood out the most was I Can't Write Left-Handed, the Bill Withers yeah. song. And I got to tell you the story about what happened after we recorded that. When the album came out, Bill Withers got a call from Bill Russell. And, you know, anybody who doesn't know who Bill Russell is, he's a legendary basketball player, played for the Boston Celtics. And he one of the most successful basketball players in the history of basketball when it comes to winning championships and mm-hmm. and his dominance of the game during that time.
Yeah.
And Bill Russell, he's a friend of Bill Withers. And Bill Withers didn't know our album was out. He didn't know that we did one of his songs. Bill Russell called him up. He hadn't spoken to him in a long time. And he told him, you know, John Legend and The Roots did a really good version of your song and you should check it out. And he watched the YouTube clip of us doing it. And he proceeded to write me an email. Bill Withers wrote me an email. And anyone who knows him knows he's a great storyteller and he's a great prose writer. Like if you just let him speak, he has so many stories to tell, and yeah. he does it in a way that's very uniquely him, and has such wit and a voice, you know, like a distinct voice as yeah. a storyteller. And so he proceeded to write an email to my manager because he didn't have my information. And my manager was like, you're going to die when you read this. And he passed it on to me. And he was just telling me how much he loved that we covered his song and that we did such a beautiful job on it. And then we became friends after that. He would, you know, we would email each other. He would come to my shows whenever we played in LA. And wow. it was just one of the most memorable aspects of making that album was just meeting him and becoming friends with him because he heard about the song from Bill Russell.
Yeah, that's an amazing, amazing story. Extraordinary. A gift that he was musically. And just the jewels he's dropping on artists you know, after his career, in a way, his performing career is over, is really precious. Yeah. I had the opportunity to perform for him at a tribute show at Carnegie Hall. And just the fact that he might know my music or you know, just call me by first name was just, it just does a lot because of who he is.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, yeah, Gregory, yeah. But he said, Gregory, you know, why don't you stop stealing from me? You know, basically. he hears maybe some influence. And so that was the way our conversation started. It was just the sweetest thing.
He was always funny and witty. And he was always aware of what was going on in music. And it was very cool to spend time with him.
Yeah, one thing that he was extraordinary at subtly and sometimes less so subtle about bringing politics into the music, mm-hmm. saying who he is politically in the music. We're going to miss that. I worry about some of the great masters in this time of where we're all separated and all segregated, slipping away into the night. He passed away, and the type of respect and love, I think, is he I don't know if he received enough because of the time.
He didn't receive enough because we normally would have a celebration of his music. We'd do an event. We would do so much for him, and it happened during this pandemic and we weren't able to do it. And it is a shame because there are a lot of families, obviously, that are going through that same experience, but it is always important for us to celebrate our legends, our icons in music, and we're usually able to do that musically and do it together in the same room, and we weren't able to do that for him.
So in that respect, it's an empty feeling, and so I find myself listening to his records in some way that's connected to my family. My brother passed away from COVID
at first.
Crazy round that was happening in New York. He lived in Brooklyn. It wasn't sudden. He was in the hospital for a long time. But when he died, it's just, and he's gone. I can't touch him. I can't honor him. I can't, you know, I sang to him when he had already passed through video. So the opportunity to properly close that chapter of a great life causes me some angst. And I wonder, I feel like the inability to honor people properly can do several things. That pent up energy can find its way and be released artistically. And I feel both with in a personal way, for my brother, it'll find its way out. And I think for Bill Withers as well, the celebration of him has got to be made. If it doesn't happen on television in the next 2 years, who knows?
Yeah.
It should happen without question some way in people's music, you know, the celebration of him. Yeah.
Maybe, you know, I have some influence with the Grammys. I need to talk to Harvey about that and see if we can get that happening because he deserves it. And I'd have to look back and see who else passed away this year. But I feel like of all the artists that passed away, I can't think of one who is more influential than he was. So,
yeah.
Hopefully we can do something to honor him there.
Yeah.
Hey guys, you're listening to The Hang. Hit subscribe or follow on your podcast thingamajig of choice to get every episode of The Hang fresh off the presses.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Back to that question, politics and music.
Yeah.
You haven't been shy about expressing yourself politically. Even in the context of making a song that even really isn't talking about politics, you're just like, by the way, there's some stuff going on around the corner that ain't right.
Exactly.
That is dope. And that's another thing that's inspiring other artists of the same caliber and younger artists as well, less established artists. Because, I mean, the suggestion that you know, just keep everything cool and don't rock the boat is kind of the story that you get out of the blocks. And what it is that you're doing is letting people know that it's all part of me. This is, you getting a whole person here.
Yeah.
You're getting a whole person. And that comes with my experience. It comes with my blackness. It comes with my politics, my desire for equality, and my desire for mutual respect. And so that's going to come out in both the interview and the music. Let's speak on that. Where does the boldness and the confidence and where does that come from?
It's interesting because I never thought that artists weren't supposed to do that. I never got the memo that we weren't supposed to. And honestly, it's because of the artists that I looked up to. So many of them were willing to speak out. A lot of them were the soul artists that we covered, you know, on the Wake Up album. But you think about people like Stevie Wonder, Marvin Gaye, Curtis Mayfield, so many of our most successful. It wasn't just, you know, they weren't just doing this and not succeeding. They were winning and doing this. Nina Simone, so many brilliant artists spoke out about what was going on in their day. A lot of it during that time was the civil rights struggle. But also it was the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
And so many of our greatest artists contributed to the canon with music that spoke directly to what was happening. And even if they weren't making a lot of political music, some of them like Aretha Franklin were donating, marching, you know, helping in some other way, supporting. So I always felt like that's part of my job description is to be that kind of person. And it was always in me. I wrote an essay when I was 15 years old for McDonald's. They had a Black History Month essay competition. And the prompt for the essay was just, how do you plan to make Black history? And whoever won would get a $500 scholarship or something. And I get their essay published in the paper. And I won the local area competition. And in the essay, all I said was, you know, I talked about what was going on in my community and how I wanted to make things better. But eventually I said, I plan to make history by becoming a successful artist, musician, and using my platform to give back to my community and fight for justice and equality for my community. And so from the age of 15, at least, probably before then, because it had to be already in my head for me to write it when I was 15, I knew that that was part of what I wanted to do in my life, was to make music and to also make a difference on a broader level and use this platform, use this success to do that. And I had no idea what even getting a record deal meant at that time. I didn't know what went into it. I didn't know, you know, all the ins and outs of the business, but I knew that I believed that that was in my future and that I was going to use that platform to try to make change.
Yeah. And so it's great to see you, whether it's, you know, in a concert with the politicians of the day, President-elect Joe Biden and Vice President-elect Ms. Harris. It's awesome to see you put that forward like that. And you know, this is such a crazy time. There's been this new overt disrespect towards people of color. Mm-hmm. And I feel like in my lifetime, during this time, I think we should absolutely speak out and use our voices and use our pen to say something. Mm-hmm. And when I go into the studio to make a record, I cannot get away from who I am as a man. Yeah. And I just so happen to be a Black man. So I must speak on the things and the places from which I come. Mm-hmm. I am an American. I'm absolutely patriotic. Mm-hmm. But my patriotism has this kind of interesting twist to it. Mm-hmm. I look at the flag and I feel like part of that fabric and that cotton that's been picked to make that flag comes from a place. It comes from a people. Mm-hmm. And so that's how my patriotism is. I say, I know the sacrifice that was made in order for me to be here, in order for that, even for that flag to be there. I know where that cotton came from.
Yeah. And we've believed in democracy more than any other people that has lived in this country, because we've always had to be the ones who had to fight for it when other people wouldn't fight for it. And because we fought for it, we made it more possible for women to get it, for other people of color to have access to democracy. The fact that we were willing to fight so hard to save our democracy has redounded to our own benefits, but it's also redounded to the entire nation's benefit. And so our patriotism should never be questioned because we've been the greatest defenders. Yes, we've been the greatest defenders of this democracy because we've been forced to.
Yeah. Require you to be who you say you are.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. We hold the mirror up to the country.
Yeah. So at the point at which we now have a president who acts like he's going to refuse to leave the White House, mm-hmm. to have him play with democracy in the way that he does, to play with it, I hold offense to playing with something that, you know, that people have died for his own aggrandizement. And so it is heartbreaking in a special way. And in terms of what's happening right now, the idea of not recognizing something that, you know, John Lewis fought his whole life for, not recognizing the vote. How do you feel about it?
Well, it's interesting you mentioned John Lewis. It's interesting you mentioned John Lewis because he said democracy isn't a state, it's an act. So it's something that we have to actively maintain. It doesn't just exist. It's something that has to be maintained. It's maintained by us voting. It's maintained by us defending our own right to vote and other people's right to vote. It's maintained by us defending the institutions that serve as checks on authoritarian power. And all of those things have been under threat by Donald Trump. And, you know, I think sometimes because he's such an idiot, sometimes people don't take his threat seriously. And I think there's some merit to that view, because I don't think he'll be able to accomplish the things he's trying to accomplish now, even with the trying to sue his way into winning re-election and all those things. I think he's going to lose because he doesn't have a case. But just think, if the election was just a little bit closer, if those margins in Pennsylvania weren't, you know, 50,000 and they were more like 500, if those margins in Arizona weren't, you know, 15,000, they were more like 150, I think we would be in serious trouble as a nation if Donald Trump thought he could sue his way into winning re-election. Fortunately, I think the margins are big enough in enough states where I think it's not going to work. But we have to be fully aware that what he is attempting to do is a coup, is a direct rejection of what the people wanted in this election. And if we are able to countenance that, if we're able to say this is okay, or this is within the norms of our everyday politics. And if we get used to that, we're in real trouble. And our nation's never been perfect, but this would be a backwards leap toward authoritarianism and away from democracy.
Yeah. Well, quite frankly, I think we have already taken a step back, because I'm at the same time, without question, glad that Joe Biden was able to win the presidency. I am disheartened that after 4 years, really 5 years, 6 years, really a lifetime of watching Donald Trump and seeing his divisiveness, bigotry, misogyny, lies, 70 million people said, that's acceptable.
Let's give him another 4 years.
I'm just saying.
Can you imagine? Can you imagine? Can you imagine seeing?
Hold on, John. Listen. Can you imagine if Barack Obama said, I'm not going to listen to what the voters. You know what? I want a third term. I'm going to just stay up in this house and sue my way into another term. What are y'all going to do? right now, there would be 100,000 people with guns standing at the front of the White House.
Yeah, it would be a civil war. It would be a civil war.
It would be a civil war. Now, he's threatening the same thing.
Yeah.
And we're just supposed to just be like, well, that's just Donald. It breaks my heart that there's 70 million people that think that that's acceptable, to play with democracy this way. It's not acceptable.
Yeah. And I think what has become clear is that the Republican Party has a base of people who believe that their loyalty to the party, their identity, their whiteness overwhelms any other consideration, overwhelms any sense of preservation of democracy, any sense of doing what's right for the country, any sense of having a leader who can deal with a pandemic in any kind of strategic, wise way. Like, he's been utterly terrible. You know, if you would have said that a year ago, you could make an argument that, okay, the economy's doing fine. He's an asshole, but the economy's doing fine. You could have had that argument. And I think, honestly, he might have gotten reelected, because most presidents get reelected, it's almost a given that they will, unless something's going terribly wrong. Yeah. So the economy was fine. He was a terrible person and had authoritarian tendencies, but there's a lot of people that were just fine with the way things were, and you could see him getting reelected. But after this year, after the loss that you've experienced, after the loss my family's experienced, after the loss that so many Americans have experienced, after the utter incompetence, the utter failure to listen to reason and science and all the things that would help us get out of this pandemic, after all of that, to still say, yeah, four more years, because this is going great. I'm like, I don't understand it. And to be clear, I don't want us to be despondent too much, because he did, when all the votes are counted, he's going to have lost by 5-6 million votes, you know?
Yeah.
So it's not that close. But the fact that we were even worried for several days as we were counting these votes, like, it does scare you. And it lets you know that the nation really is polarized, and certain folks are just going to vote for their team no matter what. And we're fighting over, one, turnout, making sure our team turns out. And then, two, there's a few persuadables in the middle that we're going to try to swing them over to our side. And I think that's essentially what happened. We turned out in overwhelming numbers, and we also got some of those folks that are in the middle that may have leaned Republican before but just couldn't stomach giving him another term. And that means we won by a significant amount, and we beat an incumbent. So we shouldn't, you know, be too despondent about that result. But there's still that 70 million. There's still that 70 million that said, sign me up. I want four more years of that. And it's like, how is that possible?
Yeah. How many times have you performed at the White House?
Let's see, probably 3 or 4, but also performed at the inauguration, a big event outside, you know, when on the mall in front of the Lincoln Memorial. So, but then what I loved about the Obama administration, they did those kind of periodic celebrations of different important American music. So we had a Motown night at the White House.
Yeah, that was amazing.
And I got to do, you know, Heard It Through the Grapevine and some Temptation stuff. And that was fun. And then I've performed at Michelle Obama's 50th birthday and one or two more times. Oh, I performed at the state dinner that they had for the British Prime Minister, Cameron at the time. Mm-hmm. And it was a great time to be an artist and to be friends with the leader of the free world, because it gave me some opportunities to be in some rarefied spaces that I never dreamed of being in when I was a kid.
This biblical the saying that your gift will take you to high places and you'll be at the table of kings has been absolutely, you know, true for yourself. And it's hard to imagine such things as a young person. And I looked at your bio and you went to university for English and African-American studies.
Yes, I majored in English with a concentration in African-American literature and culture. And so that really just exposed me to so many great authors, so many great poets, so many great thinkers about Black life in America. And I think it's informed my politics. It's informed the way I write, informed so much about who I am. But I didn't major in music. I almost minored in music.
This is my confusion. I'm like, with all that skill and knowing who you are right now, it would have seemed natural. Funny thing is, I didn't major in music as well. I didn't go to a music.
What'd you major in?
I'm city planning.
Wow. It's funny that you say that, because I have a very deep interest I'm very interested in city government and how cities are laid out. I think about segregation and gentrification and all these other things.
This was intrigued me. Yeah. Initially.
So I'm right with you in the fact that we're interested in those things. I didn't study as much as you did, but it's certainly one of the things I like, honestly think about quite a bit more than you would think I do.
Yeah, that's really something. So music wasn't your study. Absolutely, it has informed what you did study, has informed you as a person, as a man, and has informed your writing. But it's so interesting that maybe you didn't what was your thought at the time, you know, checking the box for some, you know, desired thing to study? Were you thinking, music is a long shot, or I don't need it, what was your thoughts?
It was a combination, because one, everyone says have a fallback plan. And I was thinking that, you know, I'm going to an Ivy League school and most of my friends are going to go work in the corporate world or do whatever. And so I'm always thinking, well, music might not work out, so let's make sure I have other ideas for what I could do. Part of me was thinking I would end up going to law school, because I do care a lot about politics and the law and justice and all these things. And so I could see myself going into law school and working in government or working in a nonprofit or being a full-time lawyer, whatever the case. I could have seen that being a path that I took. But I also thought that even if I do go into music, it's not like I need to go to college for music to do the kind of music I want to do. And so I never thought that the path to being a successful, you know, R&B soul pop singer, that, you know, having a bachelor's in music was a requirement. Mm-hmm. And even possibly it might've been an impediment in some ways, because it's like
time.
You might go too far in that direction of academic study. And that's not really the key to success in our business, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I just didn't feel like I needed a college music education. And mind you, by that point, I had been taking piano lessons since I was 4, off and on. I could read music. I had a decent understanding of theory and harmonics and all these other things. And I had been directing my church choir since I was, you know, 11, 12 years old. I had been arranging for an a cappella group in college.
You could teach at the university if you.
Well, I don't know if I could teach, but I had well beyond the required knowledge to do what I wanted to do in music.
Yeah.
And I didn't feel like majoring in music was going to advance my goal, advance me toward my goal of what I wanted to do in music.
Mm-hmm. Well, whatever the combination, whether it be 20 years sitting in the church pews and a few years of study in English, it's created something beautiful in you and your writing and your expression and all of the, I call it the diaspora of Black music, jazz, soul, blues, and gospel that come out of you is really something. Music and family. I think of my pains and my joys are inescapable when I go to write. And I write a song about my son. He's 7. And I'm shocked that I've had this amount of time at my computer because he always takes it over and plays his video games. Totally destroys my microphone.
Of course.
You know? But I write songs about him and for him to hear 30 years from now to give him encouragement. I'm trying to give him something that he'll have when I'm gone. I probably do that because of my father, who I saw just a few times in my life. Mm. And I even write about my father. My new record has a song called Dad Gone Thing. The song is developed based on me going to his funeral and finding out all these cool things about it. Mm. He was in the military. He was a great cook. But person after person got up on the stage and said, boy, when your daddy would sing, I'd never heard him sing in my life.
Wow.
And he lived to be when I was 21 when he passed away. And I never considered him in my music. I never considered him in my, really who I am as a person even. Always just gave everything to my mother. And so that's what the song is coming from. He didn't teach me a dadgone thing, but how to sing.
And, oh, man.
You know, he didn't give me a thing in life. I don't know how to tie a tie. I can't put a worm on a hook. I can't do all of those things that you think a daddy would teach you. My even my R's are big and voluminous like a woman would write a R because my mother taught me everything.
Wow.
But being a good father, being a good parent can sometimes come out of some difficulty. And I follow you on social media, but my wife really does. And you incorporate your children into your lives in such a beautiful way. And it's something to be commended. Does how great of a parent you are, it obviously comes from what you come from. But both the good and bad that your parents have given you can find its way into your parenting. Into being a good parent and the other way as well.
Well, it's interesting because it was like the tale of two halves of my childhood, because the first half, you could look at our family and think it was absolutely perfect. And it was experienced in my life as a really healthy upbringing. My parents were homeschooling us. They were taking us to church. They were teaching us about character. They were setting a good example. They were, you know, taking in foster kids and helping homeless people. And it was genuine. It was genuine. It was like they really cared about living their faith in a way that I thought was really exemplary. And it really was a good influence on us being people of character growing up. And then I've told this story before, but my mother had a very bad reaction to her mother passing away. And she got really depressed. She eventually developed a drug addiction because she was self-medicating to deal with the grief. And it tore our family apart. And so I spent from ages 12 through early adulthood, almost not even speaking to my mother because she was so far gone and estranged from us as a family. Even though she was living in the same small city with us, we almost never saw her for about a decade.
Wow.
And so it's interesting having both the foundation of everything being great, everything being healthy and giving us that moral foundation, I think, that we needed. And then going from that to having a period where we lost our mom. She's back now. She's healthy. She's clean. She's a great grandmother. And we get along great. But that period was really difficult for all of us. And I think it makes me think about what my role is as a husband also, because thinking about going through grief, obviously my wife and I just went through grief that was very deep and painful, and we're still going through it. Yeah. Thank you. And we're still going through that. But it made me think about how important my role is as a husband in helping my wife get through this grief while also experiencing the grief myself. And it's made me, I think, all the more committed to the idea that understanding that life is going to bring us challenges and sorrow and grief, and that part of the commitment we made to each other as a couple was to be there for each other through all of that. And I feel like it strengthened that commitment, the challenge that we've faced together, the challenges that we've faced together, have strengthened that commitment. And I think it makes it also even more important for us to be great parents, because that's the project we have together that we put the most into. It's like, this is the manifestation of our love for each other. We see ourselves in these young people, and we're going to try to shape them into great adults by giving them an example of what love means, giving them an example of what kindness means and character means. And hopefully we're going to be able to do that.
Yeah. Well, you're there for them and guide them and directing them. But in your music, do you feel like you're dropping gems for them also?
Yeah, well, I've written songs for them, just like you've written for your son. They can't appreciate them yet because they're 4 and 2. And you know, the lyrics are probably a little deeper than is at their comprehension level. But they're always going to be there. That's the great thing about music is these songs will survive us. Yeah. And hopefully will be something our kids can look back at and say, my daddy wrote that for me.
Yeah. And even just putting the energy into into the universe, I think it covers them in some way.
Yeah.
Hey, tell me at this time, what are you thankful about in your life?
I'm thankful for my family, first of all. I love my wife and my kids so much, and they make my life so much more meaningful, and they give me a sense of purpose, and they give me something beautiful to come home to every time I leave to go to work or go on tour, and I'm thankful for them. I'm thankful that I get to do what I love to do for a living. Not everyone has that opportunity, and I don't take it for granted. I feel very fortunate that I'm able to do that.
Wow. You stole the words right out of my mouth and out of my mind. I'm absolutely thankful for my family. In some strange way, I'm thankful for this slowdown that causes me to concentrate on being a dad and teaching my son big words and you know, how to stand and hold your head up high. And so, yeah. John, is there anything that you feel from this period of time that maybe once we get a vaccination that will carry over into this post-COVID life?
Well, it's interesting because obviously we've spent a lot more time with our families, and I want that to continue. And I think because we've gotten so good at doing these interviews like this, and and there's so many technological ways to be in conversation with people without leaving the house.
Yeah.
I think we're never going to go back to having to go to a radio studio and do all these other things like we used to do. And I'm just fine with that.
I remember, I just got one little story. I remember, you know how you get in a car and you drive all around the Midwest going to all these, you know, radio stations, you know, Sirius.
Yeah.
I had to do mine with rappers. For some reason, they're like, okay, you're black and you're black. Let's put you guys in a van together.
Oh my God. So, y'all are so not I'm playing in, on the I'm same the, station.
I'm in the same van as, you know, Little Shotgun and, you know. And so I get out. They do their interview first. And then I come up to do my interview. And, you know, I'm talking about jazz and soul music. And the whole time I'm coughing because the smell and the bud is still in my lungs. But anyway, that's the way it went down. But yeah, absolutely. Working from home.
And now you can do it from home.
Right. Right. No. Wow. What an extraordinary gift you are to music and really to the world. Thank you so much for having this conversation with me. You've been an inspiration, even though you're a few years younger than me. You've been an extraordinary inspiration to me nonetheless. Thank you for hanging with me, man. It's been really cool. Thank you. Yeah.
Truly an honor and to know that someone of your skill and your musical astuteness values what I do is a high compliment, and I truly appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. You know, it's funny. Astute is one of those words that I've always loved, but I get it so few and far between. It's funny. I was talking to Stevie Wonder yesterday. He wished to wish me a happy birthday.
And, happy birthday.
Yeah, thank you. And Stevie used that word as well. It's like, I praise your musical astuteness. I was like, okay.
That's funny.
I got it 2 days in a row.
2 days in a row. You'll take it. You'll take it. That's a good compliment.
Wow. That was quite something. Moving, moving stuff. So there it is. It was a true honor to have both you and John join us. And I really hope you can join us on the next episode you choose to play. Thank you if you've already told your friends about the show. You know, the best thing about having a podcast is that there is no capacity. Everybody is welcome. Until next time, I'm Gregory Porter, and this has been The Hang, a Cup and Nuzzle production.
Treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their Golden Glow body set includes 3 clinically proven bestsellers for smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set provides spa-level results at home. Both sets come in giftable boxes with savings up to $48 and free shipping for a limited time. For 10% off your first order site-wide, go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM.